This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
This is A Little Pot of Joy, the podcast program.
Welcome. This is A Little Pot of Joy, the podcast show with Alice and Andrea. Our community is made up of so many amazing and diverse groups of people, as are the programs on Joy 94.9. There's something there for everyone, and A Little Pot of Joy is where we highlight just some of these amazing programs.
We would like to show our respect and acknowledge the traditional custodians of this land, of elders past and present of the Kulin Nation, whose land we are broadcasting from.
We are opening the evening with a podcast from As I Was Saying, Sean Cole, expert fashionista.
Lana spoke to Sean Cole, who is a fashion historian, curator and writer based at the London College of Fashion. They discuss why queer communities have had such close ties with fashion, how gender and sexuality has been inspiring and informing fashion, and how androgyny is perceived and represented within the fashion world.
And As I Was Saying is always fantastic, so if you've missed a show, podcasts are available for download from the Joy website, joy.org.au/As I Was Saying.
This is A Little Pot of Joy, the podcast program.
This week we are talking queer fashion with Sean Cole. Sean Cole is a fashion historian, curator, and writer. He's the director of the Graduate School's Culture and Curation Program at the London College of Fashion. An expert in men's fashion, specifically men's underwear and gay style, he has curated numerous exhibitions, including Fashion on Paper, 1997, Dressing the Male, 1999, and Black British Style, 2004-05. Why do you think, to absolutely generalise here, why the LGBTIQ communities have shared such close ties with fashion over the last several hundred years?
I think on one hand, it's to do with creating a way of communicating, a sign, a signifier. So whether that's fashion or whether that's clothing or dress is a semantic debate, I guess. But I also think if we talk about fashion as an industry or fashion industries, I think like the kind of catering industry, like care industries, like performance industries, I think fashion offered a relatively free and safe space in which gay people or gay men, I guess it's gay men who are predominant in the fashion industries as opposed to lesbians. I think it offered a kind of space in which men could be themselves. There was a kind of, it's easy to fall into stereotypes sometimes, isn't it, when we talk about these things. But, you know, that allowance for creativity, that allowance for something that was outside of the norm. And I think fashion has always, rightly or wrongly, been associated with ideas of the feminine. And so I think perhaps in a generation when gay men were led to associate with the feminine rather than the masculine, fashion and fashion industries, fashion-related occupations, like hairdressing as well as fashion design or retail even, allowed a space in which they could be themselves.
So to ask it in a different question, how has gender and sexuality inspired and informed fashion?
I think the people who are at the edge of fashion are the ones who have tried to break down the binarism that our lives are kind of bounded by. So that idea that, you know, it has to be male, it has to be female, it has to be masculine, it has to be feminine, it has to be gay, it has to be straight, it has to be this, you know. It's that pushing at those levels. I mean, I think we see it perhaps far more interestingly in fashion. The boundaries have been broken down way more in fashion for women than for men. If you look at the kind of history of the way women's fashion has historically adopted elements of men's fashion. So in the 19th century, the kind of adoption of tailoring, male masculine tailoring techniques, the introduction of the wearing of trousers over various phases.
In my mind, that's linked to women's rights, the vote, suffrage.
Absolutely. And I think that because women had a patriarchy to fight against, whereas men perhaps more easily being in the positions of power. And again, I'm being slightly hesitant because, of course, you know, we're talking about a white middle class patriarchy, and there are a whole set of men who don't fit into that. And, you know, of course, we always have to. But I think because women had that to battle against, and in order to fight for rights and equality, often dress and appearance came into that. Whereas I don't think men have had to do that. But I think what we're beginning to see more recently, and, you know, there were designers in the 60s, Hardy Ames certainly, and Pierre Cardin, Rudi Gernreich, created non-bifurcated garments for men in the West. And of course, again, we're talking about a kind of Anglo-European, Anglo-American, westernized world, I guess, if we could move off. And things might be slightly different. But I think there is a beginning to think, well, actually, why should men have to wear those things? Why is it that grey flannel or pinstripe is a male fabric and grey, blue, brown are male colours, whereas satin, velvet, lace are seen as being female and feminine, pink, red, orange, lilac are seen as being feminine colours. And I think if we believe and ascribe to J.C. Flugel's concept of the great masculine renunciation, the industrialisation of the West and the kind of breaking down of the kind of traditional aristocratic hierarchies, the Ancien Régime, so the French Revolution, saw a kind of move where men, Flugel argues, renounced their right to ornamentation. And so that became the domain of women. I think, again, you know, you could think about that in relation to class.
Not only have we seen an evolution more so to women, I take your point around breaking down boundaries around fashion over the recent past, but I think as a non-expert in fashion, we've seen a lot of experimentation with androgyny and a neutral space between male and female, particularly in fashion magazines and on the runways, and in terms of some of the fashionista models that we see in the queer community now. Does the LGBTQ influence have something to do with this?
I think it probably does. I mean, I think certainly, you know, we have seen recently, as you say, a real wave of challenges to that binarism of gender. You've had a wave of the kind of gender boundary pushing models. So I think Andrea Pejic is perhaps the best known example. But then you have people like Casey Ledger, you know, who very much walks. And I think what was interesting about Casey and Andrea is they both walk the catwalk for both male and female collections with the kind of designers who have been pushing those boundaries. So people like Jean-Paul Gaultier, you know, who throughout his career has pushed at those edges. You know, he's the man who, he wasn't the first to put men in skirts in the West, but certainly he was the first to be celebrated for putting men in skirts, putting men in corsets. People like Vivienne Westwood. You know, then you have Galliano to a lesser extent. McQueen was doing similar kinds of exploration. So I think, you know, designers have pushed at those edges.
So do you think there is space for a third sex in fashion?
I don't know whether it's a third sex or whether the concept of third sex is always very interesting, I think, because traditionally it kind of, you know, it comes out of that late 19th century concept of defining sexual identity, doesn't it? I think what we might see potentially, or will we? I don't know. I was thinking about the attempt by, I don't know if you know about this, Selfridges department store recently opened a new department or space called Agenda. And the idea was that they were creating, selling clothing that wasn't sold by men's clothes or women's clothes in a kind of supposedly genderless collection, which in some ways I think was successful, in some ways was a marketing ploy. It got a lot of discussion. And I, for me, again, a lot of what I saw being sold there was idea of it was more masculinized clothes that could easily be worn by women, but could also be worn by men. They weren't being determined. And I wonder whether or not we will continue to see that push towards clothes that were called in the late 1960s, early 1970s, unisex.
You're on Joy 94.9, and this is A Little Pot of Joy with Andrea and Alice. From Her Voice with Emma and Anne Louise.
Sarah Waters joins Emma and Anne Louise. Sarah was in town for the Melbourne Writers' Festival and took some time to chat about lesbian protagonists, queer literary history, and her latest novels. Sarah has received international acclaim for her novels that include Tipping the Velvet, Fingersmith, and her most recent, The Paying Guest.
And we were completely starstruck when she came in, weren't we, Andrea?
Oh, it was amazing.
It was amazing. And you can listen to the entire podcast by downloading it from the Joy website, joy.org.au, or download it for free from the iTunes store.
You're listening to A Little Pot of Joy, the podcast program.
Sarah Waters is a Welsh author, well known for her lesbian protagonists and historical settings. She's authored six novels, including Tipping the Velvet and Fingersmith, and her latest, The Paying Guest, was released last year. She's won plenty of awards, and her fourth novel, The Night Watch, was shortlisted for the Man Booker Prize. Sarah has been in town for the Melbourne Writers Festival and is heading to Brisbane later this week for its Writers Festival. Sarah came into the studio for a chat earlier today, and we started by asking her if she always knew that she wanted to have lesbian protagonists and history central to her work.
Well, you know, I didn't start off writing with like a grand plan for my whole career. I just had an idea for my first book, which was, you know, Tipping the Velvet. And I'd been doing some work on lesbian and gay history and the way we think about the lesbian and gay past. And I knew a bit about Victorian gay underworlds and wanted to write a kind of fun, upbeat book about lesbian life in the late 19th century. And that became Tipping the Velvet. But then by the time I'd written that, I was kind of both hooked on writing fiction. I realised I loved it and it was kind of the job for me. And I was still very interested in history. And so each novel has kind of grown from the one before it. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. Because your work is incredibly well researched. And I know that you have a PhD, which you completed in 1995, which, I mean, I expect anyone who's done a PhD obviously has to have an interest in research. And so that must be a huge factor for your work. But your thesis title for that, Wolfskins and Togas, Lesbian and Gay Historical Fictions, 1870 to the Present. It sounds very interesting. I think it's an interesting topic. Can you tell us a bit about like that research that you did for your PhD?
Yeah, of course. I mean, gosh, it seems like a long time ago now. It is rather a long time ago. But I did, and I did love it. You're right. I mean, I you know, researching and the solitary work that you do, both as a PhD student and as a novelist, you know, kind of suits me very well, really. And that thesis was, it looked at sort of different moments in mainly the 20th century, but began in the late 19th century, sort of moments when ideas about homosexuality were changing or had changed, and the way people wrote about the past in line with that. So, for example, I began with gay men in the late 19th century talking about ancient Greece, you know, the whole idea of Greek love. I mean, Oscar Wilde was kind of in that kind of circle to a certain extent. You know, at a time when homosexuality was so kind of debased and criminalized, there was no way to talk about it positively by setting it in the present. But if you spoke about Alexander the Great and, you know, talked about the sort of Greek heroes and their homosexual loves, it was a way of being positive about homosexuality. So I started there, and then I went into the 20th century. I looked, for example, at the way women have written about Sappho. You know, lots of lesbians obviously have appealed to the idea of Sappho. There have been other historical icons, Queen Christina of Sweden, for example. She's an interesting woman that lots of people have claimed in positive and negative ways as a kind of lesbian model. I looked at Mary Renault writing in the 1950s, you know, those, again, stories about ancient Greece and the classical world. And again, a very positive way of writing about gay love at a time when in the modern world, you know, gay love wasn't possible to write positively, really. And then I ended up in what was then the present day, the 1990s, looking at writers like David Rees and Chris Hunt, Isabel Miller, Jeanette Winston to a certain extent, Ellen Galford, writers who were very confident of their modern gay identity but were writing about the past in interesting ways, you know, claiming icons and models and heroes for gay people from the past. And it led totally into my own fiction, definitely.
It's such an interesting topic. I mean, Yeah, I mean, you've done the research, so I'd rather read, the work that somebody else has already done on it. But to look at that historical aspect of it, to see that there has always been people there writing, even though it wasn't necessarily
open. Yeah, and of course, we weren't taught that stuff at school, I remember as a student coming across Lillian Faderman's book, Surpassing the Love of Men, which is basically a history of lesbianism, and it blew me away. You know, I was sort of 19 or 20. I'd just started a relationship with another girl. But the idea that there had been women loving other women, women setting up homes together in the 19th century, in the 18th century, you know, and way before that, was just fantastic and very empowering. And I think that's the thing, you know, gay communities and gay people have always used the past as a way of supporting the present, as a way of saying, look, you know, we've been here for a long time. You can't say that we're freaks. You can't say we're unhealthy. You know, you can't say that we've got to shut up and be invisible because we've always been here. And of course, homosexuality, has changed as our ideas about homosexuality have changed. But that's part of what makes it interesting for me. And with my novels, I both want to kind of say, you know, yeah, you look, here's the 1940s, the 1920s, the 1890s. Here are women, you know, loving other women. But they're not doing it in quite the way that we might do it. And that's fascinating, I think.
Mm. And so is that, you mentioned empowering before to find these older works. So is that a deliberate thing on your part to have lesbian protagonists and to have lesbian love stories in your work? Is it partly as an empowering thing for people who might be reading this, or is it just purely because, you know, that's what you're interested in writing about?
It's mainly just where my interest lies, you know? It's not like I've got this mission to kind of remind everybody about lesbian and gay history. I think it's more that I'm interested in the past, I'm interested in domestic life, because we don't get told so much about those, about domestic life, you know, about what went on behind closed doors, what went on in people's bedrooms, what went on in their bathrooms. So I'm interested just generally in those rather secret histories, the histories of everyday life, really. And I'm also interested in, you know, in the secrecy that surrounds lesbian and gay lives in the past, and in trying to recapture them, in trying to reinvent them, perhaps, if we don't actually have the information. And there is a political element to that, you know, I know there is. But basically, you know, I'm just doing what any novelist does, which is to find stories that intrigue them, to create characters that can embody kind of issues and themes. And I just want to write with kind of emotional realism, really, about these worlds and just tell a good story at the end of the day.
Now, your stories are often set in London or in and around London, and so they're exploring some of the queer aspects of London's history. Lesbians, I mean, in general, our history hasn't been as well documented as that of gay men. Does that make it difficult to do some of your research and to write accurate stories of the time?
Well, it doesn't. I mean, it's true, isn't it? I mean, you know, gay men have often left more of a mark on the historical record because, gay male life has been criminalised, so gay men have been arrested. Oscar Wilde, you know, the great big public kind of display, really, of homosexual issues in the late 19th century. And we've never really had an equivalent for that kind of thing. I mean, in the UK, you know, lesbianism was never criminalised. And we had the Well of Loneliness trial in 1928. That was probably the nearest we got to it, with that, you know, the Well of Loneliness being banned.
I haven't heard of that trial.
What's oh, really?
That? Yeah.
Well, The Well of Loneliness, you know, the novel, the Radcliffe Hall novel. I mean, it's a very inoffensive novel, really, but it was quite a strident defence of lesbian life, lesbian love. And I think it was the Sunday Express launched a kind of campaign against it because they saw it as corrupting. And the Home Secretary got on board and banned it. It went to court. And so it became a really, really kind of public thing, and did an awful lot to advertise lesbianism and advertise the novel. So it became, for many decades, The Well of Loneliness was the lesbian book that people might have heard of or, you know, might have read. But on the whole, no, lesbian life has sort of got under the radar, you know, under the radar of the historical record. And we have what we have, a kind of fragments. You know, we might have police records about women cross-dressing. Some women we know, you know, lived in almost in marriages with other women, with, you know, passing as men, and were only discovered by accident or something. We don't know were they lesbian? Were they what you might call trans? You know, we don't know. But it's very suggestive material all the same. So there's things like that. There are sort of odd letters or diaries like Anne Lister's diaries from the early 19th century. A Yorkshire gentlewoman who kept secret diaries in code, and it turned out that she was recording her many passionate lesbian affairs. So there's bits and pieces like that on which, as a novelist, you can build. But at the same time, weirdly, not having much evidence can be a bit of a gift for a novelist too.
Now, your latest novel, The Paying Guests, was published last year. It's set in 1922, mm-hmm. This book, which is a new time period for you that you hadn't worked with before. So can you tell us a bit about the book and what London was like for lesbians then?
Yeah, well, the book is set in sort of what was then still a bit suburban in South London, Camberwell, and it's set in a kind of middle-class home inhabited by a young unmarried woman called Frances Ray and her widowed mother, and they're middle-class, but they've been running out of money, they've lost their servants, they have to bring in lodgers, the paying guests of the title, who are a young married couple, Leonard and Lillian, and sort of unexpectedly, Frances and Lillian become quite friendly, and then they become a bit more than friendly, and it leads to all sorts of terrible and wonderful and scary consequences. So it's a kind of a love story that's also a bit of a crime story, really. And it was a great novel to write. They go on a bit of a roller coaster ride, so it was quite emotional to write it. And in terms of what London was like for lesbians, it was a really interesting time for women generally. You know, women had gained so much after in the wake of the First World War. They'd got a lot of new freedoms. They'd done new kinds of jobs. Even their clothes, you know, had changed. If you think of the difference between those Edwardian costumes they used to wear, those great big leg of mutton sleeves and the big hats and the big hair and the long, heavy skirts. You know, by the early 20s, they were wearing much slimmer, shorter dresses and, you know, hair was cut shorter and corsets had gone and things like that. So it was lots of loosening up going on. And that was true in terms of, sex and sexuality as well. Birth control was becoming, you know, kind of talked about and used. And homosexuality was being kind of discussed. Of course, it depended what circles you moved in. You know, Daphne du Maurier, for example, living in a kind of arty, bohemian, fairly wealthy circle, she was having lesbian affairs as a teenager, and actually both her sisters did too. You know, relatively unproblematically, they were kind of having affairs. But we know much less about what was going on for working class women and lower middle class women. But certainly change was in the air and sexual adventuring was in the air. So for Frances and Lillian in The Paying Guest, you know, Frances, we discover, is a woman who's already had a kind of lesbian experience and is very confident about her sexuality. Lillian is married and so is discovering this stuff for the first time. But they both see it very much in terms of, you know, life is modern. You know, we've been through this terrible war. We've got an opportunity to find real love with each other. You know, we've got to seize that opportunity. And I think there was that general feeling around, a bit like the 60s, you know, change was in the air and people were trying out new things.
You're on Joy 94.9 and this is A Little Pot of Joy with Andrea and Alice. Up next from Tuesday Afternoon Joy with Stephanie, Miss Murphy.
Ms. Murphy chats about how her life has changed since appearing on The Voice in 2013 and what she has learnt about the music industry.
Ms. Murphy also chats about her new album, Dirty Soul, the recording process and her upcoming live shows.
And if you just can't listen to the show live, download the podcast from the Joy website, joy.org.au, or the iTunes store.
This is A Little Pot of Joy, the podcast program.
You're on Joy 94.9 and I'm here with the lovely, soulful artist, Ms. Murphy. How are you going? Thank you for being with us.
Oh, thanks for having me.
How are you feeling? My goodness, you're such a busy woman at the moment.
Very excited, that's for sure. The album's out and I've been waiting to release this one for a while now, so I'm very, very excited about it.
Yes. How long have you been working on this one for?
I think we originally came up with the concept around the beginning of the year.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just been a very steady process in picking the songs and recording and releasing and tour dates and things like that. So, yeah, it's been a little while.
So would you say that you started working on this straight after The Voice, or was it a little bit of time after?
No, there was about a year later we started working on this album. Previous to this one, I've recorded two EPs.
Yes, yes. I've had the pleasure of listening. They're fantastic.
Oh, thank you.
I want to know, obviously, you did the reality program, The Voice. You know, how was it before The Voice, and how did it change your career after?
Before The Voice, I dedicated my 20s to working in the church.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't gig around. I didn't know how the music industry worked or anything like that. And it wasn't until I was about 28 or 29 that I tried to get a couple of local gigs at my local cafe, and I got rejected a few times. And
wow.
I just didn't know how it all operated and what I was supposed to do. So I was in a position where I felt like I didn't kind of have any other choice but to take a chance. And so when I auditioned for The Voice, I got callbacks and things like that, and The Voice has most definitely changed my life. You know, it was my lucky break, and now I'm, a signed artist with Universal, which is really exciting for me, and if I didn't go on the show, I wouldn't have any of these opportunities that I have now.
And what with the opportunities, how did you, now that you've been in the industry and after the show, how has it helped your knowledge throughout the industry? What have you learned?
I think I've learned a lot in regards to who I am as an artist and what I want as well, what I want to sing and how I want to sing and what I want to say as well. You know, that's really important to me too, and just how the procedures work and, management and, practical things like booking agents and labels and, my demographic and supporters and things like that, and just how driven you have to be to really put your best foot forward in the music industry and give it your best shot.
Absolutely. How much work altogether do you put into your career, would you say? Is it sort of every day, every night kind of thing? Do you switch your phone off some days? How do you do it?
I'm not sure how I do it. It's full time, you're dedicated to this. It's not you can't kind of switch off and stop thinking about it for a day or whatever. It's definitely my life has been poured into this, and because I love it and because I want to try and aspire to being a better artist and hopefully grow as an artist and grow with my supporters as well.
Well, you definitely have some really strong influences. Now, particularly this new album, which is, dedicated to that old school, bringing that old school back. What's your goal with these new tracks now?
I think for me it's really important to remember where soul music has originated from.
Mm-hmm.
And why it's so influential. And
yep.
Back then they had a lot to say. They weren't just kind of singing songs. There was a lot of meaning, and it took a lot for them to break through barriers, to do what they loved.
Mm.
And, I think that spirit has really made their music so influential for future generations, So, yeah, that was honouring them in this record was really, really important to me.
You approached by Paul Kelly. He loved it.
Yeah, Paul Kelly is great. He's such a gentleman, and he's an Australian icon, and it was such an honour to sing his songs and to put them on the album, and to have his support is truly remarkable for me. So I'm very, very lucky.
And with this album, I mean, you didn't just go to the lengths of recreating these songs. You recorded like they did back in the day. You did it all live. It's so different now. How did you find that experience?
It was exciting.
Yeah.
And it was there was a lot of pressure as well because, when you're recording live, one person, if they make a mistake and then everybody's kind of made a mistake,
so
they have to do the track again. And,
yep.
And we really wanted to try and keep the authenticity of the music and honour the people who originally recorded the songs.
And even the, would you say even the flow of, you know, the way you'd sing it, you know, there's definitely, would you say there's a different feeling when you're recording it all in one take and whereas, you know, in bits and pieces?
Yeah, most definitely, especially when you're with the band and everyone's together and you're sweating it out in the studio and there's a lot of energy in the room.
Yeah.
You feed off each other and that just encourages, you know, everybody just to give more and to be generous with what you're giving.
When people hear these tracks, what do you want them to feel? Do you want them to reminisce? Do you want them to groove along? Is it a bit of everything?
I do think that I want everyone to feel the music, most definitely.
Mm-hmm.
And I want them to enjoy the experience of music as well. And I wanted them to kind of catch what it's like at one of my live shows. It's very authentic, it's very honest, we bear everything.
Mm-hmm.
So that was really important to me, to capture that dynamic that everyone should expect at a live show.
And do you feel like you're encouraging people to get on the journey with you? So when you've come up with these tracks that you've put on this album, have they all got a different significance to your life and to a meaning to you?
Most definitely, yeah. There's, you know, there's a gospel song on there and I was brought up in church, and there's the Rolling Stones on there, and I have I love rock music, and Tina Turner, you know, she's a beast.
Yeah.
And I love that about her as well. And so all these songs are very, they've all influenced my life. And that's the kind of genre that I really, really love to sing.
And when you go back, I mean, you've come such a long way. And when you go back to your church and the people that first saw you sing, what do they say? Are they just so happy? Like, what is it? What's the feeling like now?
My church family are very, very happy for me, very genuinely happy for me and very excited for me as well. I think sometimes they get more excited than I do. I don't think anyone that knows me has kind of felt like, I should get over it by now or something. They're very supportive of me and very, very excited for me.
And, you know, obviously with this tour and all your shows and you've got the band and everything, what do you do before you get up on stage? Do you do like a little ritual? Is there, do you pray before you get on stage?
I think I try and take it easy. I try to stay quiet and focused and be present in the moment and not worry about anything else apart from performing and giving it my best shot.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for chatting to us. And the album is out now, yes?
Yes, and the album is out now and I have 5 shows. I have 1 show here in Sydney on the 8th of October at The Basement, and I have 4 shows at Chapel of Chapel on the 20th to the 23rd. So I hope to see everyone there.
Yeah, definitely. Well, there you go. Well, thank you so much for chatting to us today. It was a lovely conversation. It's great that you know, your honesty in your music really reflects in the way you talk as well. So thank you so much for sharing with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
No worries. Thank you.
You're listening to Joy 94.9 and this is A Little Pot of Joy with Alice and Andrea. Up next, a podcast from On the Line with Dean Beck. Since the fertility clinic in East Melbourne opened its doors in 1972, protesters have stood outside harassing young women as they entered.
The previous week, the Supreme Court found the City of Melbourne could do no more to protect the women who attended the clinic. As a result, Fiona Patton, MLA, issued a private member's bill in Victoria Legislative Assembly to create an exclusion zone of 150 metres around the clinic.
And Dean put together a background package on the clinic, the protesters, the legal action and the thoughts of Victoria's Premier. Then Fiona joins Dean Beck to discuss the latest developments.
You can listen to the entire podcast by downloading it from the Joy website, joy.org.au/on-the-line, or download it for free from the iTunes store.
You're listening to A Little Pot of Joy, the podcast program.
The fertility clinic in East Melbourne first opens its doors in 1972. Now, since then, protesters have harassed women of all ages attending the clinic, regardless of the reason as to why they were attending. That harassment continues to this day.
We're here to offer help to women who are coming in to seek an abortion and who may never have been offered any other course of action, and we're here to try and do that. And of course, society has already made the decision that babies are not human beings, and therefore that they should be disposed of at will, and that is something that we find objectionable and offensive in its own way.
Now, last week, the fertility clinic took the City of Melbourne to court, saying that the city wasn't doing enough to protect the women attending the clinic from the protesters. This is the lawyer representing the clinic prior to the findings of the Victorian Supreme Court.
The Fertility Control Clinic has brought the Melbourne City Council to court. We're arguing that the Melbourne City Council has a duty to remedy nuisance occurring out the front of the clinic that involves harassment of staff and patients as they enter the clinic. We're really concerned about the treatment of staff and patients, the harassment that goes on by people calling themselves the helpers of God's precious infants is very serious, and it's caused a lot of stress and harm to both patients and staff, and we're hoping that the court will order that the Melbourne City Council take steps to remedy the nuisance that's going on. This is not a case of peaceful Christians silently, politely expressing their views by any stretch of the imagination. The people who stand out the front of the clinic do not consider themselves to be protesting. They consider themselves to be trying to stop women accessing abortions. And that is totally unacceptable in a state where abortion is decriminalised, perfectly lawful, and in some cases an essential health service.
Now, the court found in favour of the city, and while the judge acknowledged that the harassers were causing a public nuisance, they found the city had no case to answer. I spoke with Melbourne's Lord Mayor last week about this issue.
We won a case in the Supreme Court yesterday on behalf of the City of Melbourne, but that's a win that doesn't give me any pleasure. I mean, the vile behaviour that's been going on there for 20 years will be going on today and tomorrow. I think, if anything, this is a catalyst to say to ourselves, to the clinic, to Victoria Police and to the state government, we've got to get our heads together and work out an effective way to stop these vulnerable young women being so horribly harassed at a very difficult time in their lives.
So who are these people and what the hell are they on about?
They want to criminalise dissent. They want to silence everybody because we are a reminder of the horror of what's going on inside. They're saying a woman's right to choose is absolutely outrageous euphemism. I mean, what does right to choose mean?
We're not there to judge or condemn anyone. We're not there to judge or condemn anyone. We're just there to help people.
Over the past 21 years, we've helped over 300 girls who have changed their mind right outside abortion clinics.
These models in themselves have saved over, since I've been using them, over 30 babies.
The Premier of Victoria, Daniel Andrews, had this to say when he spoke to the Hacks, Tom Tilley, just last Thursday.
I don't think anyone should be interrupting anybody else in getting the health care that they need, legally, privately, appropriately. These are often very challenging and difficult times in the lives of women and the people who love them. And for people to be interfering, to be intruding, is simply wrong. I think it's clear that there is need to reform in this area. And we're looking at that bill very closely. We're also, officers of my department and the Attorney General's department and others will look at the judgment from the Supreme Court very closely also.
But these wackos are continuing to harass people. They're determined to do so, and this is why.
We believe there's never justification for a woman to have an abortion. Even though the mother may feel very bad about having been raped, it's still her son or daughter. So that would having an abortion then would really be harmful for her psychologically as well. Look, we know some girls who in our movement who have been raped, have the babies, and they love the babies absolutely. You've got to remember that a baby's life is at stake, and we have to plead for the life of the baby. We call ourselves life advocates. That baby's life must take precedence over the feelings of the mother. Unfortunately, abortion is now the most widespread and systematic act of violence in the world. Between 40 and 50 million babies killed by abortion every year in the world.
This is what a caller to Neil Mitchell's show had to say last year.
I had a termination done over 20 years ago after I was violently raped. It's just so distressing. These people don't know what the women go through when you're raped. violently or any with your rape.
Fiona Patten is the member of the Legislative Assembly who has led a private members' bill to address this issue. Fiona, thanks very much for joining us on the line.
Thanks, Dean.
Fiona, you've been at protests, protesting the protesters for quite some time yourself, and it's come to this. The state government looks like they'll be supporting your private members' bill.
Yes, we had a joint press conference the other day with the Health Minister, Jill Hennessy, and she committed to reworking a private members' bill, keeping the intent, but reworking the sort of the back end of it and reintroducing it into Parliament next month. The Premier also committed to this, so I'm extremely pleased that they've supported me on this. And yesterday, during some of the debate, the Coalition was given a free vote on this. And it would appear that the majority of the Coalition also supports the intent of this bill, which is to provide some safe access to people attending abortion clinics.
Now, the Supreme Court last week, in their findings against the City Council, had some pretty stern words to say about the protesters.
That's correct. I mean, they said they were a nuisance. I think nuisance, it sounds a little bit soft for what they actually do.
But public nuisance is a criminal offence.
Well, that's right, that's right. And, you know, it's not just, you know, being childish. This was harassment and intimidation. So I think the court was quite right. You know, I know the Mayor, Robert Doyle, has also welcomed my private members' bill, because the council was finding it very difficult to control these so-called curbside councillors. And as that Supreme Court case found, that while they might have been able to do more, they were not wrong in what they did.
Is 150 metres enough?
Look, I think so. And this was, we modelled the bill on the Tasmanian legislation, which has 150 metre safe access zone. I think it's about finding that balance between free speech and freedom from harassment. So I think we do need to find that balance. And, you know, just so people can get off the tram or park their cars or, you know, walk into that clinic without some old man calling them a baby killer or some old woman shoving a photo of a fetus in their face.
A bloody mutilated fetus at
that.
That's
right. That's right. That's right. I mean, it's really offensive. And the police are very happy with the distances. Look, in reality, the final result of the bill may actually have smaller safe access zones.
I've never mentioned this publicly before, but I accompanied a female friend to that clinic for a procedure once and experienced what goes on with those protesters. I also covered for Joy 94.9 one of your first protests at the front of the clinic. And it was a case of who gets in first as to who had to stand across the road from the clinic, the sex party got in first that day. The harassment is objectionable, and I'm very pleased to see that it has the potential to stop.
Yeah, I'm really pleased as well. And it was interesting in the process of doing of this and the debate and, yeah, obviously speaking to a lot of media, the people who called in and recalled their experiences like you have was overwhelming. And people were really shaken up by it. And there was a study down that found that, you know, a lot of women attending the clinic when there was that harassment has been going on were actually more distressed and harmed by the harassment than they were by the actual procedure.
Well, as we heard in the package just before, these people also think that if you're raped, you should give birth to the child that you're carrying.
Yep.
And
yep.
They think that's fine.
That's right. And the other thing that they neglect is, you know, at those clinics, there's people going there for all sorts of reasons.
Yes, yes.
You know, some of it could even be things like, you know, a miscarriage that they then have to go in. So people are going in there with sometimes a lot of baggage. Well, not baggage, but they're going in there for lots of reasons. It might be that they've just had word that the fetus is terribly deformed, or, you know, they don't know why people are doing it and going in. And they, you know, this notion that they want to just council people is what they call it, which is, you know, just absolute rubbish.
They stick their heads in car doors and tell women that they're murdering their children.
That's right. And they're not councillors. They haven't, you know, they don't have a degree. You know, it's absolute rubbish. And as we've said many times, I don't like their message, but I am very happy to see them each morning when I come into Parliament. And they can stand out there and they can protest and they can lobby the politicians about the laws, and that is quite appropriate. It is completely inappropriate for them to harass and intimidate women going through a very difficult time, and the staff who have to face it every day.
They are very odd people.
Yes.
There is no two ways about it, and their motivations are twisted at best.
Exactly. And this is about people having the right to choose. You know, it's very often, it's a hard decision, but it is a decision that a woman should be allowed to make for herself, and no one should be interfering with that decision. And as I say, it is often a very difficult decision for people. And then to have these, you know, generally older men out there harassing and intimidating you and shaming you for this decision that you've made about your own reproductive health is entirely unacceptable, and I don't understand why they think they have the right to do it.
You've been listening to A Little Pot of Joy with Andrea and Alice. You can find more of the complete podcasts on the Joy website, joy.org.au, or download them for free from the iTunes store.
You've been listening to A Little Pot of Joy, the podcast program. See joy.org.au and click on our podcast link to subscribe to your favourite podcasts free.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.